You are listening to Over and Back's Basketball Mysteries of the 1970s. Today's mystery is, could Wilt have saved the ABA? Could anyone have? All right, we are back. I am Jason. With me as usual is Rich. Rich, how's it going?
Not too bad. How are you?
Probably better than the San Diego Conquistadors are doing. I would have to say.
They're not doing too well these days. 2016, the
no.
Conquistadors of the ABA not doing well. The league struggling a little bit as well. But, you know, new season coming up here in October. So I think the ship will be righted finally for the Qs.
One of these days, the Qs are going to make it.
With Wilt as the coach, player coach, they got it. Everything's in place. I don't know why it's not going to work, but.
Yeah, absolutely. So we talked a little bit about the Qs before, the Conquistadors, the only ABA expansion team in history. And their owner, Leonard Bloom, decided
to... Not to interrupt, but it's a very fun fact because we had that episode in the series where we went over, like, how many... honestly, I forgot what the number is exactly, but there's, like, 25 or something teams. But, yes, there's only one expansion team because everybody else moved and changed names and did all that stuff. So crazy. We did a whole episode about it for people that want to know. But it's fascinating that there's one expansion team. Yeah, there's, like, 25 different team names and cities and all that sort of stuff. It's just crazy.
Yeah, exactly. And, and we went through some of the crazier owners of the league as well. Leonard Bloom popped up on there, and he signed Wilt Chamberlain, coming off of a finals appearance with the Lakers in '73, to a $600,000 per year contract to play for and coach the team. He said, "Wilt's my player coach with the emphasis on player," and they immediately distributed media photos showing Wilt in a Q's uniform holding an ABA ball. You can find it pretty easily if you Google it. Bloom said in Loose Balls, "The other ABA owners laughed at me when I said I wanted Wilt, but after I signed him, the owners gave me a plaque because it was such a coup for the league." And he actually played in 4 exhibition games, averaging 18 points. I cannot find anything, any more specifics than that.
That's all I could find, too. That's all I really have ever seen anywhere, which is interesting, but, you know, given the time in the league and all that. But, yeah, you would think, like, Wilt playing in exhibition games in, another league would have been something a lot of teams would have covered, or a lot of newspapers would have done a little bit more coverage on. But, yeah, it's really hard to find anything about those exhibition games.
A California court ruled that he could not play, but he could coach the San Diego franchise, and so he did. He coached the team, although was more of a, you know, a figurehead type coach. He was around, and he, you know, did spread his authority every once in a while, but I think most people agreed that Stan Albeck was the real coach. Interesting that other issues with San Diego, and we went into it a little bit on the previous show, but they were locked out of the huge arena because of a personality conflict, the sports arena in San Diego, which seated 14,000. So their arena was the Peterson Gym on the campus of San Diego State, which had a capacity of 3,200, and the marketing campaign for the team was the tallest coach in the smallest arena, which
I love it. That's good. That's I was gonna say, well, the Kings are getting a new one. Who's the, I think I'm trying to figure out who the what's the smallest arena now in the NBA. I was gonna say Sacramento probably for a while, but maybe Milwaukee until they get their new digs. But I think someone else should take this up as well, because there's nothing better than making light of how small your arena is. But hey, you got the tallest coach, so that's fine.
Like, yeah, so, you know, yeah, and they averaged about 1,800 per game.
That's not
so
great.
Didn't even do so well. So Wilt's coach. Not quite the coup that everyone was hoping it would be.
Not at all. And as you mentioned, Stan Albeck was essentially doing a lot of the real coaching. You know, Wilt had been quoted as, you know, "I felt from the start that Stan Albeck was the real coach. He never placated me, but he was willing to do whatever I wanted him to do. A lot of the press would ask, does Wilt show up for practices? And he handled it extremely well, because, you know, the answer is not all the time is that answer. So Albeck said he learned from Wilt about working with big men and expectations and all that sort of stuff. But the team said, the team remarked that, you know, Wilt wasn't a terrible coach, that they got some tough practices under both, but that it was really, I mean, Albeck was doing a lot of the heavy lifting, but Wilt was still, it wasn't like he was completely out of the picture. He was there to an extent. For people who don't remember Stan Albeck, he went on to coach the Cavaliers, Spurs, Nets, Bulls, as well as Bradley University through the rest of his career. So he ended up carving out a really nice kind of head coaching career in the NBA. But yeah, this was his first kind of beginnings as a quote head coach here as an assistant. But yeah, there was a bunch of other stuff about Wilt. Alex Hannum, who was a former coach of Wilt Chamberlain, said that Chamberlain has great feel for pro basketball, but the day-to-day things that are an important part of basketball just bored him. He didn't have the patience. And then, yeah, Wilt kept a suite at a San Diego hotel, and he commuted for games and practices in his multi-million dollar Bel Air mansion, but it didn't always work out all that well. Alex Groza, who was the Conquistadors general manager, recalled that Wilt would often take a PSA plane that landed at 6:30 or 6:45, and the game started at 7:30. He had a guy pick him up at the airport to get to the games on time. And then also Graza went on to say what would have made a great coach if he had applied himself. Having played under various systems in his career, he could have applied those philosophies to his own, but he didn't take the time to do it. Still, I've always liked Wilt. He was his own person, and he chose to live that way. So, you know, there's some interesting stuff there of him, you know, maybe not showing up on time as much as he should and some other stuff. But again, people, you know, players always seem like they were into it. There was rookie Bo Lamar, who was a Conquistadors rookie, and he said it was a great experience. Wilt was very knowledgeable about the game, and he taught us a lot, not only about basketball, but about other things. He told us about staying in condition, playing to the best of our abilities, and having fun. So, you know, there's some benefits, at least to an extent, of having sort of that guy. I mean, that's obviously a guy that a rookie would look way up to. And then I'm sure he was great with the big men, but yeah, it was like the day-to-day stuff that you could really get a sense that Wilt just wasn't into all that well. Regardless of, you know, all the kind of turmoil going on in the coaching ranks, like, Hughes were actually a pretty good team. They were better this year than they were during the 73-74 season. In this season than they were their first season. They improved from 30 to 37 wins. They had Casey Jones as their original coach, so they had a nice little lineage of ex-players as coaches. The Q's biggest talent was rookie Caldwell Jones. He was, you know, skinny, but a talented 6'7 center. They also had the aforementioned Bo Lamar, who averaged more than 20 points per game, and had one game with 50 points as well. Team also had ABA vets Stu Johnson and Red Robbins. Chamberlain also signed a few of his old Laker teammates. Travis Machine Gun Grant and Flynn Robinson were the guys. And the Q's were a wide open team. They took about 194 more three-pointers than any other team, but only made 27%. So not the best idea all the time. And their defense wasn't very good either. But, you know, not a bad team. Now, 37 wins, they're okay. And, you know, Wilt's not a complete meltdown as coach, but it wasn't what it was really advertised or at least hoped by a lot of people to be.
Yeah. And there was a good feature on Wilt as a coach from a 1991 article in the LA Times, which threw a lot of good details in. And it's also talked about quite a bit in Loose Balls as well. There's some interesting Wilt in the ABA stories. Wilt quoted himself. He says, "I remember playing the Nets with Dr. J, and we had a great deal of success against them. I threatened my players by telling them, if you let Dr. J dunk the ball, you'll answer to me personally. Back off 15 feet and allow the outside shot, but don't let him get to the basket." So, now, Irving did score his career high against the Q's, but that was a year after Wilt had left, so you can't necessarily blame that one on Wilt. And center Gene Moore said, "Every day there seems to be a different star at practice. One day Andy Williams was here. Another time was Archie Moore. Wilt works out with us, but a lot of times he has to stop and talk to some young lady on the telephone. And then Wilt will later call Moore a fat pig and cut him." So it didn't really work out so well for Gene Moore. There's a really great story from Loose Balls about a brawl that went on with the Pacers and Mel Daniels, and, you know, the Q's and Pacers player are getting into it, and there's, you know, words being exchanged and heated things going on and some exchange of fisticuffs, and then suddenly Wilt picks up Mel Daniels like a toothpick. And Mel Daniels was one of the toughest, you know, biggest guys in the ABA, right? And, you know, put him away, and that, you know, pretty much ended it right there, just kind of showing the different level of physicality that Wilt was on from anybody else. And Gene Littles, who was a guard for the Cougars, talked about, you know, even as coach, Wilt was a draw. When San Diego came to Greensboro to play the Cougars, we sold out.
Yeah, unfortunately, nobody in San Diego agreed with that, but right. That's all right. Hey, yeah. He's a traveling draw. That's cool. That's still
which,
counts.
Yeah, that, which is, you know, common for big men. I mean, that was something Wilt dealt with in the ABA. You know, that's why the Warriors eventually traded him, because, you know, he was doing well on the road, but wasn't really doing that well in San Francisco. So that was kind of a common thing. Unfortunately, I think for that Greensboro game, Wilt either didn't show up or showed up late, so that wasn't the best impression. Too. Yes. Mike Storn, who was the commissioner of the league, there were some complaints about Wilt wearing sandals on the road. Apparently, that was an issue. I don't know why, but...
I love Wilt. Wilt's the best. Like, yeah. Just shows up.
So
20 minutes late, he's wearing sandals, he's talking to some lady on a phone. It's the best.
Yeah. So Storn, you know, approached Wilt, and he was really intent intimidated by, you know, because Wilt's a big guy, and, you know, could, if you got mad, it would obviously be intimidating. But, you know, Storen said he brought it up, and Wilt was nice about it, said, you know, no problem. I'll, you know, I'll follow the dress code. It's not a big deal, even though he even said it was kind of a ridiculous thing. There's also a story from practice where there's a ball that gets stuck up in stuck up near the bat or somewhere up high, and no one can get to it. And then Wilt eventually jumps up to get the ball while wearing a suit and new dress shoes. So not even wearing basketball gear, he can jump higher than anybody else to get the ball. And there's also a story about, you know, Wilt kind of, you know, being involved during a practice and getting beat by Caldwell Jones, who spun off a pick and dunked. And then Wilt saying, run it again and I'll break somebody's arm. So he wasn't going to be, you know, beaten even, you know, he wasn't going to get embarrassed even in a situation like that. And then Wilt said that coaching was one of the more unexpectedly fulfilling years of my pro basketball career. I enjoyed coaching, and I think I did a decent job with what I had to work with. The ABA at that time was as strong as the NBA. So, you know, I think the question is, if Wilt had been able to play, would that really have made a significant difference for the ABA? Because we're into 74, and that's a time where the talent level with the ABA and NBA is fairly even. You know, the ABA, Irving is an established star. They have George McGinnis. They have some top-level talent. But there's also getting to the point where the franchises, some of them are kind of on their last legs and starting to decline. The Squires are having a rough time. The Stars are starting to have a rough time. The Qs obviously struggle. So there's sort of these two parallel tracks. And you wonder if Wilt at that point being able to play would have brought the league enough attention where it would have been, you know, in a significantly stronger position for lasting longer, or whether it would have been able to, you know, be in a better position for a merger.
Yeah, I think at least short term, I think it would have been a pretty good coup. I mean, of course, you know, Wilt at this point in his career is starting to wear down a little bit. But just the idea that Wilt Chamberlain is, you know, superstar, I think from the optics standpoint of just the idea that, hey, this former NBA superstar, a guy that's still, you know, arguably you could say is still a superstar in the NBA. Of course, you know, while he's, you know, winding down, he's still a big time part of that Lakers team that had just recently made the finals. He's still, you know, still in a relative prime of his career at the tail end or whatever. And I think that would have really, I don't know, again, like, is it going to keep the league alive? Is it going to do all that? I don't know. But yeah, at least for mergers to maybe expedite, or at least to, yeah, is it, again, make, you know, San Diego a legit market, make, you know, maybe a few more TV games, something like that. I mean, I don't see any way that it wouldn't have helped, or it would have made it. I think it on a would have made some amount of difference just having Wilt on there. I mean, just the optics of Wilt Chamberlain playing in the ABA, I think is a huge deal.
Yeah, I agree. I think it would have made, it would have certainly been helpful, but I don't know if it would have been, you know, a big splash. Now, there was talk about the Qs moving to LA, you know, which theoretically, if he'd been able to play and move to LA, although probably they would have been done better in San Diego and probably would have stayed there, maybe even made a deal to get into the sports arena, which they eventually got into, but by then it was too late for them. But yeah, I mean, I definitely think that, yeah, is it enough to save the league? You know, questionable, but maybe, you know, a couple years of stronger business and they're in a better shape for the merger, or maybe, you know, it even entices the merger to happen a little bit quicker because, you know, we can still get Wilt, who was, you know, when the NBA lost Wilt, it definitely was harmful to the league, you know, in terms of, you know, drawing crowds and that sort of thing, drawing attention. So
absolutely. Yeah, and even if you played 1 year or whatever, just get new eyeballs on the league, just understand that the league has, you know, oh, wow, geez, they got Wilt Chamberlain, you know, hey, and again, like, because people will mention, and, you know, Wilt's in his quote said it, and everybody, that around this time, it's like the ABA is getting very close in talent gap, and just having a guy like a Wilt Chamberlain play in your league and show that, hey, look, this is, you know, these are the guys he's playing with, just adding some extra eyes on the league, just adding extra news reports, just adding extra stuff like that would have, I think, just done a lot, even in the short term, just to get that ABA in a better standing. But yeah, again, like, would it have saved the ABA? I mean, probably not. I mean, it probably would have been a short term, if anything. But I do think there would have been a difference, or at least a benefit of him getting on the court, but versus him coaching, where I just don't know if there's that much of a real sexy story there about, like, Wilt Chamberlain's coaching, and, like, it doesn't help too that he really didn't care. So
yes, unless he's getting into fights with Mel Daniels, you know, every night.
Yeah, covered. That would have been a good story, but nobody was there, so.
Right. So looking at a few of the other key NBA players who jumped to the ABA, We've addressed Rick Barry and Zelma Beatty elsewhere. Those were the first two major stars. Barry, of course, you know, really being the a huge star for the NBA and being a huge Q. A couple of others that stand out that were actually were teammates for a little bit while. First is Billy Cunningham of the 76ers, who went over to the Carolina Cougars.
Yeah, so in 1969, the Cougars, they signed Cunningham, who was he was still under contract with Philadelphia, of course, for the 69-70 season. So they signed him to a three-year, $455,000 contract to take effect after he played out his option year in 70-71 with Philadelphia. The Cougars also tried to get Luke Jackson from the Sixers, but that didn't work out. But regardless, they got Cunningham. He tried to back out of the deal because the Carolina was missed a payment. But the courts eventually ruled in favor of the Cougars, which we will maybe talk about here a little bit later in another show that you listen to. But yeah, he ended up going to the ABA and doing pretty well. He ended up as the ABA MVP in the 72-73 season. He averaged 24 points, 12 rebounds, 6 assists, and 2.5 steals per game while shooting a career-high 49% from the field. Unless you think that the ABA competition or lack thereof inflated the numbers, the Cougars went 5-1 against NBA teams during the exhibition slate that year. So they had a great exhibition year and just a great team overall, led by, in his prime, Billy Cunningham. The Cougars had their first winning record under Larry Brown, of course, former ABA player, now young head coach and man we still know today. Larry Brown is 57-27. They fall to the Colonels in 1973 in 7 games on a real tough series. Carolina's fortunes then worsened the next year as Cunningham missed all but 32 games with a kidney ailment, and the Cougars fell back to 47 wins. Cunningham did come back in time for the postseason, but he disappointed. He only mustered up about 7 points and 5 rebounds per game in about 20 minutes per night. He was obviously just not healthy at that point yet. He still needed a little bit more time, and the Colonels swept the Cougars, and Cunningham played his last game for Carolina. He went back to Philadelphia 74-75, but a decent little run there with an ABA MVP mixed in, and really kind of changed the fortunes for Carolina, at least for a year or two. So
yeah, and that, by the way, that account was from Curtis Harris of Probes History. So I should give him credit for that. And Cunningham's teammate Joe Caldwell, he actually jumped from Atlanta to the Cougars in 1970. He actually was able to go straight to the league because of a sort of an odd loophole where the Hawks had offered Caldwell less than 75% of his previous salary, which apparently violated the reserve clause in his contract and made him a free agent outright. So that was a very rare circumstance that went on. Usually the players who jumped from leagues had to sit out for a year. Caldwell was mad because the Hawks signed Pete Maravich to a huge contract and felt slighted when they wouldn't pay him a similar deal. And talent-wise, he was certainly worth it. He'd averaged 21.1 points a game for Atlanta. Atlanta had gone to the division finals and was a 50-plus win team. Had a potentially was a team that was on track for a conference finals or a finals appearance, but that team was sort of broken up because of Maravich. Interesting how there's sort of a split in the owner of the Cougars, Ted Munchak, said he'd never seen him play and didn't know who he was. Carl Shearer was the GM, ran the operation, said we had to have a guy like him, where Shearer said in loose balls that Munchak from Atlanta wanted Caldwell, and he didn't really wasn't really that excited about it. Caldwell and the Cougars, not really a good marriage. Caldwell was a really great, versatile player, could do nearly anything, but being a go-to scorer was not good for him, and he constantly battled with his coaches and management and ownership. Even the idea of selling his contract back to Atlanta is broached. He managed to make the All-ABA second team in his first year. The second year, he missed 23 games with a knee injury. And then the 73 season that we talked about with Larry Brown coming in, Cunningham added to the team. There were a few alpha dog issues between Cunningham and Caldwell, but otherwise the team got along fairly well. And as you mentioned, went to the division finals where they lost to the Colonels, but he had a very successful season. Then the team slips, Cunningham is hurt, and then the franchise leaves for St. Louis. Caldwell and Steve Jones are basically the only holdovers to that regime. And then 74-75, St. Louis management blames Caldwell for influencing team star Marvin Barnes to briefly leave the team, and the team's management claimed that Caldwell had led Barnes astray, which, he needs a lot of effort to do that. He was suspended for activities detrimental to the best interest of professional basketball. He never played another pro basketball game and had filed various lawsuits over the years because he believes that he was wrongly blacklisted by the ABA and later the NBA. And then he ended up suing the Cougars owner over his pension, which he, that case he won. The, most of the cases ended up being dismissed. But so not really a happy situation for Joe Caldwell, unfortunately, for him or his team after that.
Not at all. Next guy on our list, Dave Bing. Yes, Dave Bing. He had planned to sign with the Washington Caps. The Oakland Oaks had moved across the country to Washington and were having trouble convincing Rick Barry to come with them. Of course, that was be a constant thing there. Owner Earl Foreman, who we mentioned many times in this podcast throughout, and especially in our ABA owners or our owners of the 70s episode, which you definitely check out. He needed a big name to draw in fans, so they went after Bing, who was from D.C. Bing was really underpaid with the Pistons, and he was more than happy to jump to a new league. Signing for $500,000 for 3 years. He began to regret the decision when Foreman announced the team would again be moving to Virginia. And like Rick Barry, he was not very happy about moving to Virginia to go play ball. So this gave Bing a loophole to opt out, and he renegotiated a 3-year deal with the Pistons for almost the same money. So, you know, there were some questions if he just merely used the ABA as leverage or if it legitimately was the decision to go to Virginia that really changed him. But you can see, I mean, there was some, if you really do a search for it, I found a few different news articles, and I think there was a preview in Ebony magazine that's talking about, oh man, Dave Bing coming to the ABA or whatever. Like, it's a big deal. I mean, this is a guy who, you know, was really a big time player, and him jumping to the ABA was going to be a big deal for the ABA and especially for that franchise, the Oaks, Caps, Virginia, whatever the hell you know, franchise. And yeah, him deciding not to go, you know, that kind of hurt the franchise in a lot of ways, especially when, you know, then it coupled with Rick Barry also not wanting to go to Virginia as well. So just not a really good time for that franchise. But that'd been really cool to see Bing and if there was probably gonna be a tough time to get Bing and Barry to come at the same time, but at least one of the two would have been really cool to see in Virginia. But nope.
yeah, unfortunately not really working out. Yeah, it's interesting. Most of the players who went to the ABA had some level of regret about going. I mean, the guys who, you know, came out of college and went to the ABA, you know, a lot of them obviously did fine and had a great deal of success. And, you know, and obviously Irving left on fine terms, you know, with the merger. You know, McGinnis left a year early, but that went fairly smoothly. But for whatever reason, the people who came from the NBA, you know, it either they ended up jumping back to the NBA or they had just weird career situations that didn't go well. Recently learned about also Lou Hudson was looking to jump, you know, in the initial year of the ABA, and the courts are forced him to go to St. Louis without being able to go to the ABA. Of the initial guys who all signed ABA deals, Barry was among those, but also Wayne Hightower, Jim Barnes, Bob Love, Clyde Lee, Joe Strotter, and Chico Vaughn. Only Hightower and Vaughn ended up actually playing in the ABA, you know. So there were a lot of, in the very, very early years, there was a lot of guys who kind of teased going or tried to go, but, you know, there really only were a handful of instances of established, you know, NBA players that NBA teams would have wanted actually going to the league. Most of the other NBA guys, you know, were not one. Now, some of them, like a Freddie Lewis or, you know, guys like Roger Brown or Doug Moe, or, you know, who had been blackballed by the NBA, never played the NBA, those guys obviously ended up establishing themselves, and there were, you know, good opportunities for those guys who had talent and could have made it in the NBA had they just had the right breaks. But as far as guys who kind of had proven themselves in the NBA, there aren't really that many who really, you know, made a huge impact. It's more of a limited thing than I would have expected, you know, before kind of doing the research on this.
Yeah, exactly. And the thing you always get with all these is that the money is coming there. I mean, the ABA is willing to pay these guys a lot. I mean, whether the checks are going to clear, that might be another story.
Or that money is going to, you know, actually be there in front, or whether it's going to be deferred 20 years is another issue too.
Yes, but, yeah, which we'll talk about in another episode as well. They had a nifty little way of saying, yeah, here's the money you're going to get. Oh, by the way, you're not going to get it for another like 30 years. But yeah, it's actually not a bad investment. We'll talk about it later, sure, a little bit, but you get a lot of those. But yeah, I think I forgot exactly whose quote it was. It was one of these guys. I'm blanking on who it was, but just said that, like, even at that first game, you could just tell that this was just a different thing. Like you said, the guys coming from college, they didn't know any better, so it was like, oh, this is fine, whatever. I'm getting paid big money to, you know, play in the league, and I don't have to wait another year in college, or I don't have to wait another 2 years. Like, that's really cool. But for people that had been in the NBA and seen, you know, that level of professionalism in basketball, to come to the ABA where there was some, you know, issues with the refs, issues with the arenas, where are we going this, you know, where are we going, you know, where's our team moving to, who the hell's our coach, you know, just so many things that I'm sure as a player you know, if you had seen another opportunity or had been with, you know, the NBA before that, coming to this league and seeing all this whirlwind stuff, where some guys, you know, generally did not know that this was, you know, not the norm to have just a completely crazy league at all times. Those guys in the NBA are probably looking at it like, oh, geez, this is just ridiculous. So I could see it. But yeah, I'm surprised that there weren't more that moved over just because that money was really flowing. But yeah, when you get down to it, there's really just not that many that did it.
Yeah, you know, the ABA did chase after names. We talked about Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, obviously, the ill-fated forgetting or just not bothering to give the million-dollar check by George Mikan. They went pretty hard after Pete Maravich, but he chose the NBA. Earl Monroe went to a few ABA exhibition games and, you know, didn't end up and went back to the NBA. John Havlicek was approached, but wasn't really interested. Elgin Baylor, Wilt Chamberlain, you know, were approached in the late 60s, but that obviously didn't happen. So, you know, they tried to a certain extent to get guys, but there was definitely, you know, not as much interest as you would necessarily think. I mean, obviously the ABA was not a, you know, it was a new thing and it was hard to know how it was going to be. And, you know, it obviously had the issues of instability that we kind of went through. I don't know if there's anyone else who really could have made, you know, a huge impact. I mean, you know, Kareem or Maravich, you know, you could definitely see having some box office appeal and bringing some more attention, but you know, the ABA seemed to do better with its homegrown superstars for the most part. So that probably would have, you know, I'm just not sure there was really going to be a path forward for them to, you know, find the right star. You know, they probably would have just had to have several stars and, you know, and just kind of keep that pipeline going in order to be able to, you know, survive or at least be merged in a stronger position than they did. All right. Well, thanks, everyone, for checking us out. You can find us on iTunes and Stitcher or wherever you listen to your podcast. Please leave us a rating and review if you're into what we're doing. You can find us at harvardparoxysm.com. And we're on Facebook and Twitter at Over and Back NBA. So thanks for listening, and we'll be back again soon.